our first program, Ron Jacobson. Ron Jacobson is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Media and Media Studies. He's also the associate dean of Fordham College at Rose Hill. And thank you. Ron is the author of a book on television research, another book on New Yorker cartoons about television, and he is the co-editor of a book called Communication in Cyberspace, which is also edited, co-edited by Stephanie Gibson and me. I don't know what else to say about him except that he's from California, but we forgive that. Ron Jacobson.
Thank you, Lance. And I think we owe Lance a show of appreciation for all the work he's put into this conference. And of course, he had the vision. A lot of people helped him, and thank you for coming. I think we have a very interesting panel, and without further ado, you've seen the titles of the papers. They're very interesting. I think also the introductions that are in your program are very interesting. So I will read those, and then we'll have each of the speakers talk to you for 15 minutes. Unfortunately, time tells us that we won't be able to have questions and answers after the session, but during the reception tonight at 6 p.m. or immediately after this session, maybe you can talk to these speakers. Our first presenter is Bob Dobbs. Bob was born in Paris and after World War II worked with international intelligence agencies for many decades. He surfaced in 1987 on CKLN-FM in Toronto and began whistleblowing. Two interpretations of Dobbs are circulating in the popular media. One is through the Church of the Subgenius that Dobbs inspired in 1978 in Dallas. The other is on two CDs, Bob's Media Ecology and Bob's Media Ecology Squared, put out in 1992 by Time Again Productions, early students of Marshall McLuhan. The best presentation of Dobbs' work is in his book, Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Today he travels the world explaining our victory over the Android meme, and the tracing of these activities are regularly published in Flipside magazine. The title of Bob's talk today is McLuhan and Holeopathic Quadrophenia, the Mouse That Roared Syndrome. Bob Dobbs.
I'm probably the only person here, other than Lance, who has attended every talk over the last 2 days and intend to talk to attend the subsequent ones following me. So, yeah. It's not endurance, it's just that I feel that besides the documents from the largest archives on McLuhan outside of Langley, Virginia, and the National Archives in Ottawa, to quote McLuhan, I've been gathering ammunition for years and I hope to use it. Besides that, this, I find that every speaker over the last day and a half is supporting what I propose, which may be new. I think it's new, but of course the user is the content, so there'll be lots of arguments over that. And my new view, I think, needs to be supported by as much documentation as it can get. So I'm hoping Lance will put me at the end of the anthology so that I can include every talk that went before to support what I'm going to say. So, again, to quote McLuhan, I'd like to clear the air of FUG, F-U-G. I would say that since everything in Marshall's work replays Finnegan's Wake, but it is a Finnegan's Wake made up of the dialogue between Joyce, Yeats, Eliot, Pound, and Lewis, so not just Joyce, I would say, since the wake is the search for the letter, that one letter published in the Letters of McLuhan that I would say articulates his program, and is everything he did after that is consistent, subject to the effect of Sputnik. That letter is the one to Ezra Pound, June 22, 1951. So check out the letter sometime and read that letter. It's very interesting. McLuhan states the problem that he is going to deal with. All right. Beginning with 1960, I'm going to deal with the period 1960 to 1990 and using the McLuhanist theme that the effects precede the causes. Literate culture dealt with the causes creating the effects. Electronic culture dealt with the effects merging with the causes. But I think McLuhan understood how the effects preceding the causes was a result of what happened in October 1957, the Sputnik flight. Now, it's interesting. That's 100 years after Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil. I'd say give McLuhan 3 years to assess the impact of that in 1960, and he begins to talk about the satellite environment that early, 1960-61. Anybody wants the proof of that? These are in rare articles. Unless you're a McLuhan scholar and read every article, you're not going to find 1960-61 that easy, but you will see it in 62, 63, 64. He goes a lot into Telstar. But what's interesting is early as 1962, he is saying that television is archetypal. Now, the old theme that McLuhan used was that a new technology becomes the last word, then it becomes a cliche, then it becomes an art form, and then it becomes archetype. So by 1962, he's saying that television is archetypal. So that means the computer environment, which comes after television but before the satellite, is an art form. And this is proven in a quote from a journalistic article in the Star Weekly magazine, March 10, 1962, by a relative of mine, a well-known Canadian writer named Kildare Dobbs. To encounter McLuhan is to be drawn immediately into a dialogue, his word, he says, that is brilliant, bizarre, stimulating, exhausting. He does not fool around with talk about the weather, but blowing a little cigar smoke like votive incense over his listener takes off at once for outer space. In orbit with him, one looks down to see the comfortable world of familiar facts diminished to the scale of molecules. Long vistas of history yawn frighteningly. The slow accretion of human experience over the centuries races by like a speeded up movie. The discourse becomes even more exciting and alarming when one realizes that this is no carefully planned, guided tour of theories already worked out and tested, but the actual adventure of improvising and elaborating new ones. Now, what's interesting about this quote is that he's describing the experience of McLuhan in person as going in orbit, literally, like a satellite, and looking back at the planet. However, he says that McLuhan is not working from any planned, guided tour of theories, but that it's an improvised thing. I propose that it wasn't improvised, that it was planned. So I go back to 1960 to a quote to illustrate the computer as art form. This is a letter to Jacqueline Tyrwhitt, December 1960. Today, with electronics, we have discovered that we live in a global village, and the job is to create a global city, city in italics, as center for the village margins. The parameters of this task are by no means positional. With electronics, any marginal area can become center, and marginal experiences can be had at any center. Perhaps the city needed to coordinate in concert the distracted sense programs of our global village will have to be built by computers in the way in which a big airport has to coordinate multiple flights. So there he is. He wants to move out of the global village and turn into an art form via the computer. By 1962, the effect is as a satellite, and he's talking about the satellite. Now, the main point that Marshall says in understanding media is not that the medium is the message. He says that to explain the changes caused by the medium is easy. What is really difficult to explain is the numbness or the ignoring of that fact. And he proposes to explain what that numbness is. So, removing the idea of the global village, because he wants to look at it as a global city programmed by the computer. But by 62, 63, 64, the satellite environment has now approached, he says, art form status. He moves to the global theater. Now, the global theater is not a term he uses until the late 60s, and there's a reason. So, by 1960, if he was given the chance with his ambition and the knowledge he accumulated through his interaction with Joyce and the other writers I mentioned, with Innes as a front, if he was given control of the United Nations, he would implement the computer in a programming situation. Now, that was not likely to happen. So, as he says in Gutenberg Galaxy, to explain the numbing effect of television, he says in particular, would be futile at all. It would be futile to discuss it. So that means the applied knowledge, in the sense of efficient causality, and I would see the four causes as symbolically relating between Joyce, Yeats, Pound, and Eliot. Efficient causality, to apply the knowledge that he felt he acquired, and therefore mock the academics in the 50s, as stated in the June 22nd letter, that the research was a red herring by the others, but not his. Since that wasn't likely to happen, he was left with a strategy to, in a sense, be an artist. But I maintain that he wasn't an artist, that he didn't want to be an artist. There are many artists in New York, in Toronto, who were around McLuhan in the 50s and 60s and didn't understand when they did performance pieces with him how he always knocked them. And it's interesting because I think if he was given the chance to implement his understanding of the numbness, then he would be a doctor. He would be dealing with as he called himself a pastor, the new germs, the new diseases. Now, he was always ready to do that if given the chance, and probably as an existential move, he would study the effects of that if given the chance to become the director, literally, of the Center for Culture and Technology. But since he was not going to achieve that too quickly, he moves into a theatrical position in the global theater. Because the technological cycle had been completed, he sees that television creates fusion, where the users are inside the machine and the machine is inside them. But he understands that the satellite is something that it goes beyond the dynamic of the crowds presented by the history of media. He sees media as crowd behavior interactive with machines. When the satellite transcends the crowd dynamic, which is completed with the fusion of television, and in that, the computer is the interval between the television and the satellite, seeing that there was a kind of autonomy for the crowds represented by the satellite, the satellite could be detached, like the eye, from the historical cycle of crowd involvement with media. So, here he is. He's a doctor in a burning global village where, if given the chance, after his classification of the symptoms, which he did in the 50s, and his diagnosis, he then would be able to prescribe the computer's art form. But since that was not likely, then he had to move into the idea of creating something, theatrical efforts, that would be not science fiction, which was what he said Mechanical Bride was, not satire, since satire was futile. So what could he do? He could remove himself from the scene and have the media be the actors that he would direct. So you have in Understanding Media the statement, TV caused drastic changes in radio programming and in the form of the thing, italicized. TV caused drastic changes in radio programming and in the form of the thing or documentary novel. I say that the documentary novel is what he did, but it isn't him. He is not in it. So, if you go back to something he wrote in the 50s about the values of separateness, you can see that he could retrieve the book, which was his concern in the 50s. What use would the book have, knowing its effects and services and disservices? So, this little mouse, the book medium, retrieved as an archetype, would be like the story in Understanding Media, the newspaper story of the mouse attacking a cat that it sees on TV. This mouse, he could figure out a way to make it roar. So, in the global theater, which was a programmed environment, he could mime the programmers as a great playwright. But the great playwright would be the logos as experienced through literacy. I would say speech and writing. You can see how that resonates with what other people have said earlier, as Don Thiel has said. The integration of speech and print as a retrieved antidote to recreate separatism of perception, because he felt that the private citadel of consciousness was not affected by media. So perhaps that is the Logos. That's the religious part of himself. Now, that is all that's left when language is subsumed in these new media and then disappeared by the effect of the satellite. So he would bring back the book to offer temporary relief, or as he says in referring to Lewis, a carapace, in relation to the mystical attractions of the electric light. He says that in 1969. The mystical attractions of the electric light. So if you look at Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media, I think the structure is the Apelian. The Apelian is a very interesting hidden form that Marshall writes about in Cliched Archetype, that he says, it is not so much a story of the individual quest for perfection as it is a history of collective crime and punishment, an attempt to justify the ways of God to man. Now, Ted Carpenter told me that when Marshall had his surgery in the late 50s, had that operation during the making of Project 69, he wished he'd died. He recovered, and he wished he had a stroke, apparently. He wished he'd recovered. He wished he hadn't recovered, because he said that he felt he was speaking God, that God was speaking through him. Now, if we define God as a Logos, I think the fact that he privately talked about the alphabet as an important medium at the time of Jesus Christ, that he saw a religious dimension in the alphabet, and he can see that in the book. But on top of that, he also was in a spiritual crisis, because he knew that was obsolete. So you have Gutenberg Galaxy as part one of the Apelian, which is always a two-book structure with an interface, and book one is a retrieval of the Logos' archetype, but book two, Understanding Media, is a cliche probe of his own time, retrieving the past, retrieving the I. Now, Understanding Media has 33 chapters, so probably it has an embed, and Donald Thiel can elaborate on particular conversations he had with McLuhan on this level. 33 chapters refers to the Freemasonic conspiracy that he's rumored to be interested in all his life. The 33 degrees of Freemasonry. Now, that would be the content of the book. The book was the period. The Gutenberg Galaxy, he said, was the period when people could conspire and take over large groups of people. So if he's going to retrieve the eye and the book, yes, include the conspiracy. So that's the hidden mapping of the 33 degrees and 33 chapters in Finnegan's Wake. How's the time? About a minute. So what you have is the satellite is a retrieval of the conspiracy, because it's the eye, it's the prince of the air. Then from there, in the late 60s, the satellite environment is superseded by the instant replay and the chip. So to move along quickly, what happens is that he then comments on his previous process in the books from War and Peace and Global Village on, 68 on, where he lays out a commentary on the obsolescence of the global theater. Now, all of this predicts the hologram. He said the hologram comes after these media. Now, the hologram gets subsumed between 1960 and 77, and you have nothing but retrievals. Then you have, and that is a world of a memory theater. Continuing, when the android meme shows up in the middle 80s, that is a retrieval of William Burroughs' biological theater. Now, I have just finished my first paragraph of a long dissertation that goes on for at least 25 years. So I will not accept any complaints at my pretending there's a finish line. So anybody who wants to deal with some of this stuff later, they can read the article. But we're getting close, right?
We're there.
I want it to be an anti-environment to McLuhan and not be media res. I prefer to be stuck at the beginning. So I rest my case, even though you haven't heard it yet.
Great. Thanks, Bob. A little performance theater here, too. Great.
No.
Our next speaker is Marvin Kittman. Marvin has been the TV critic of Newsday since 1969. His column, in which he is listed as the executive producer, is called The Marvin Kittman Show and is printed in Newsday 3 times a week, as well as in syndicated newspapers across the country by the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. He's the author of 8 books, the latest being The Making of the Prepotent, 1789. He is the co-author with George Washington of George Washington's Expense Account. His other 6 books are I Am a VCR, The Coward's Almanac, The Marvin Kittman TV Show, You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover, The Red Chinese Air Force Diet, Exercise, and Sex Manual, and the number one bestseller. He's a graduate of City College of New York and the winner of several awards, including the Townsend Harris Medal and the Folio Award, and the Society of the Silurians Humorous Writing Award and Special Commentary Award. Marvin hopes to be remembered most for being the author of Kittman's Law. On the TV screen, pure drivel tends to drive off ordinary drivel. The title of Marvin Kittman's talk today is The Invention of Lasagna Made the Pullman Car Obsolete, or How I Got Marshall McLuhan's Message. We're very happy to have Marvin Kittman with us.
Thank you. With that wonderful introduction, I can't wait to hear what I have to say. Back in the days when I was starting as a TV critic, actually 1967 at the New Leader, everybody had to have a position on McLuhan. Thinking on McLuhan's ideas at the time was sharply divided. Some people thought he was right, others thought he was wrong. The majority, however, were in another group, which public opinion analysts sometimes refer to by the technical terms don't knows or don't cares. The truth was, amazingly, a lot of people were still afraid to have any opinion about the great Canadian philosopher. This was understandable. Tom Wolfe had explained that McLuhan was perhaps the most important thinker since Newton, Darwin, Freud, Einstein, and Pavlov. Many assumed that the kind of appraisal necessary to arrive at an opinion about whether McLuhan was right or wrong would take years of close study. I had that same misconception. For years, I had felt guilty about not coming to grips with the man's work. Having no opinion, I used to dread the subject when it was raised at cocktail parties. When a girl in deep cleavage asked me what I thought of a point like, schizophrenia may be a necessary consequence of literacy, I would answer, I missed that one. Damn that Evelyn Woods course. Thumbing through one of his books, I came across an interesting McLuhan theorem. As people become more involved, he wrote, the less they know. He had a very good point there, I said to myself. Later, when I applied the theory to McLuhan's work, I found it really held up in practice, too. I became fully relaxed about McLuhan. The less I knew about him, the greater was my understanding. Since conquering my irrational fears and anxieties, nothing gave me greater pleasure than turning other people on to McLuhan. One way to get his message, I used to explain, was by reading his books. There were 3 major works, Mechanical Bride, 1951, The Gutenberg Galaxy, 1962, and Understanding Media, 1964. If this is the way you want to go, I would add, there were several things you should know. 1, don't be put off by McLuhan because he was difficult to understand. There are only 2 things about his writing which made this so, the style and the content. Even intelligent men had found McLuhan a challenge. The style is viscous fog through which loom stumbling metaphors, wrote the Oxford fellow Christopher Ricks. When Professor McLuhan used big words, I would explain, this was more than compensated for by the organization of his material. The man's work reads for pages, observed Professor Benjamin DeMott of Amherst, like a Marlboro clearance ad. Marlboro was the leading overstock book sales emporium of the 1960s. This meant that you could start reading McLuhan on page 78 or 191 without losing the drift. McLuhan's scholarship was vast. He has looted all culture from cave painting to Mad Magazine, wrote critic Dwight MacDonald, for fragments to shore up against the ruin of his system. These multi-layered references, I would explain, sometimes made things as clear as frosted glass. It's perhaps typical of very creative minds, wrote Professor Kenneth Boulding of Michigan, that they hit very large nails not quite on the head. And in a final note of despair, Professor George P. Eliot of Syracuse confessed, it is not possible to give a rational summary of McLuhan's ideas. Early in my study of what many critics of the day were calling McLuhanancy, I recognized why these men were having so much trouble with their basic McLuhan. They gave it their undivided attention. The secret of success with McLuhan was giving him your divided attention. I always read him with the television set on, although I'm sure the radio or a hairdryer worked just as well. It was the mixing of media, McLuhan said, which makes children in this electric age so smart. Television hockey games, I discovered, were an especially useful tool for increasing one's understanding of McLuhan. What we had here is the same environmental principle one finds in action when he drinks a glass of tea while reading Tolstoy's War and Peace. McLuhan, as you know, was a Canadian. Hockey was the national sport of Canada. Now, I didn't know whether McLuhan was a hockey fan or not. It was perhaps significant that hockey was one of the few subjects he did not make reference to in his works. But many of his chapters read as if they had been written while somebody was listening to the game. The primary offensive strategy in hockey is to shoot the puck into the opposing team's defensive zone. Then the attacking team rushes after the puck and sees what happens. On Madison Avenue, this is called running an idea up the flagpole and seeing if anybody salutes. McLuhan calls this thought process exploring. I am an investigator, he wrote in a brief introduction to Gerald Emanuel Stern's important anthology, McLuhan Hot and Cool. I make probes. I have no point of view. I do not stay in one position. Frank Mihaljevic, the brilliant and eccentric center of the Toronto Maple Leafs, explained his style in essentially the same way shortly before he had a nervous breakdown. At any rate, I gained so much confidence by giving McLuhan's books my divided attention that by March 1967, I was able to consider accepting an assignment from the New York Times Sunday Book Review to review his newest book. If it had been any other philosopher's book, I would have bowed out immediately, pleading ignorance. But I felt that I understood McLuhan as much as any of the other critics. When the editor mentioned the name of the book, The Medium is the Massage, it reminded me of what Samuel Goldwyn once said. If I want a massage, I go to Luxor Baths. But I agreed to look at the book anyway because I was curious about whether I had really gotten McLuhan's message. The Medium is the Massage was a major publishing event in 1967. For the first time, explained Jerry Eagle, the coordinator of the book, Marshall puts his message in terms anyone can understand. He is a genius. As was my way, I turned on the Stanley Cup hockey playoff game between the Montreal Canadiens and the New York Rangers and began reading the paper version of The Medium as the Massage. It took 27 minutes. When the media finished working me over completely, I found that I couldn't agree more with everything McLuhan had been saying all those years. We differed on one point. I naively thought the commercial was the message. There was no longer any doubt in my mind that I was a McLuhanite. So I urged people who read the New York Times book review on that particular Sunday not to buy McLuhan's newest book in either the paper medium or the hardcover medium. Professor McLuhan argued forcefully in his work that the invention of television makes books obsolete. Anybody who purchased the McLuhan book, I explained, is playing into the hands of his enemies in the intellectual establishment. High sales figures could only discredit him as a prophet and thinker. besides the invention of the Albert Schweitzer chair, then a $100,000 seat in the humanities, Professor McLuhan had taken the previous fall, made the need to buy his books obsolete. Anyway, I just thought that Professor McLuhan might have been reading the reviews, so I had a parenthetical note. If I was wrong about this theory or any of the others I was advancing thus far, please understand that I'm only probing. By that I mean I'm trying to think linearly. Before I fell under your influence, I reasoned circularly. Anyway, that was just a personal note. Anyway, the proper way to study McLuhan's ideas was to watch them being presented on television. Print, he said, is a hot medium. Television is cool. Hot was something which involved only one of the senses, visual, oral, etc. These mediums included print, radio, topless waitresses. Cool was a medium involving all the senses at once, i.e. television. It was considered to be McLuhan's most nonsensical idea. Back in the late 1960s, the TV industry was hot about McLuhan's theories, especially the part that said TV was the most important media in the electric age. This was like telling an ugly woman she was beautiful. As a result, a major commercial network, NBC, even gave McLuhan an hour on a Sunday afternoon in March 1967 to explain his message. The invention of Marshall McLuhan made obsolete the way we judge a man's ideas on television. It was no longer possible to use the outdated criteria to form your opinions. It is not what he says that is important, but how he says it. If the medium is the message, one must use such new criteria as, one, if a philosopher's eyes are closely set, he looks sneaky. Two, be suspicious of the man who doesn't look you in the eye while he talks to you. McLuhan opened his discussion of McLuhanism that afternoon on TV by looking at my refrigerator in the kitchen. He looked at my dog sleeping in the corner of the living room. He even noticed that my wife still hadn't made the beds upstairs at 4 p.m. In the 60 minutes of this otherwise cool show, he never once looked at me in the eye. This may explain why I finally found a few of McLuhan's concepts questionable. For instance, he argued that television is a superior educational tool than a book. If he was right, that meant every parent who yells at a child, shut off that damn TV set and do your homework, was hurting the kid. But there I went again, falling into the old trap of discussing the message instead of the medium. The third and most effective medium for getting McLuhan's message, I argued, was on the telephone. If the wheel is an extension of the foot, as the professor correctly reported, and the book is an extension of the eye, then the telephone must be an extension of the ear. According to McLuhan, the spoken word is the most emotional form of communication. But to have a really meaningful communication experience, it was necessary to establish a connection. When I raised this problem in my Times Review, I solved it by including Marshall McLuhan's private telephone number at the University of Toronto, 416-WA8-3328, along with a recommendation that readers ask him directly for the message. Random House, the publisher, was charging $10 for McLuhan's message in its laughably 15th century media, the hardcover book. Bantam Books was charging $1.45 for its pitifully dated media, the paperback. But the cutting-edge people at AT&T were charging only 80 cents for a long-distance message, the station-to-station rate from New York City at the time. I advised serious students to call him after 6 p.m., taking advantage of evening rates. And if anybody wanted to show the professor they really understood the workings of media, they might call collect. This would have been an absurd proposal in 1964 when McLuhan published his definitive work, Understand Media. The message was still well hidden. By 1966, however, McLuhan had rendered all the fat out of it. He boiled the message down to 17 words. In 3 minutes or less on the phone, McLuhan could have easily given a person the whole message and still have time left over to throw in a couple of his one-liners, like casting my perils before swains. It seemed like such a sound, with-it way to get the message directly into the ears of the people that I was surprised McLuhan hadn't thought of it himself. When he had to leave his office, he could have left a message with his secretary. If he got bored with the hands-on teaching, he could have used another wonder of the electronic circuitry age, the recorded message. And if there was no answer in Toronto, the people could always call a medium and ask her for a message. Later, I learned that 327 New York Times readers followed my advice and called the professor concerning his message. While this may sound impressive, more than a million people went out and bought the book. I never realized how widespread was the movement to destroy McLuhan. I found out about these facts in a curious way. Several months after the review appeared, I received a mysterious phone call in my office in New Jersey. "Will you accept the call from a Mr. Marshall McLuhan?" the operator asked. She added that he was calling from San Francisco and that it was collect. "It depends on what he has to say," I answered. "I'm familiar with his work." The operator said she could not find out what his message was in advance. I explained that I was a starving writer as a freelancer at the time, but a phone call hardly would make a dent in Professor McLuhan's stipend at Fordham. "Money is a metaphor," I said, repeating one of the important McLuhan thoughts memorized early in my studies. Mr. McLuhan answered over the operator's voice, "The medium is the message." While I argued with the operator about how I didn't think the phone call sounded like it would be worth much, and that I definitely had not accepted charges, Mr. McLuhan went right on talking. He announced what he claimed was good news. "You've been awarded the electric chair in Canadian literature at Fordham." This was confirmed by another voice. It sounded like Father John Culkin, S.J., director of the School of Communications at Fordham, but I couldn't swear to it. There was so much confusion with the four of us talking. As soon as the two other voices joined the discussion with the operator and myself, it became obvious that a collect conference call was in session. The phone company was going to get stuck with a big bill. Mr. McLuhan monopolized the conversation, quoting liberally from the truths in his book. Occasionally, I tried to hold up my end of the conversation, saying things like, "The invention of eyeglasses makes lasagna obsolete." "What?" he asked. A little less sure of myself, I answered, "The invention of the Pullman car makes the draft lottery obsolete." My intellectual hero said a lot of things, most of which were beneath the dignity of his high office and my stature as a TV critic. I still don't know what he was so mad about. Over the years, I continued being a leading McLuhanite TV critic. I was the first to realize that since the medium was the message, the way to view television was not from the old-fashioned vantage point, i.e. the front of the screen, but to turn the set around and review the back of the set where all the action was taking place. Watching the oscillators and rectifiers humming in symphony with the Orthicon 2 was a thing of beauty, much more fascinating than the Captain and Tennille, Tony Orlando and Dawn, and even Supertrain. It still is. I'm sorry I went on so long, but just charge the phone company for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Barbara Jo Lewis. Barbara Jo Lewis is an assistant professor in the TV and radio department and the business department at Brooklyn College. For 15 years, she worked in the advertising industry as a producer, as well as completing several award-winning documentaries. The title of Barbara Jo Lewis's paper today is Children of the Mechanical Bride, Additional Abstractions of Human Stereotypes. Barbara Jo Lewis.
A mind floated in a 6-foot robotic vacuum cleaner, a human brain in a 72-foot armored dreadnought, another mind controlling a humanoid body composed of magnetic rings. These are some creatures of mid-century American science fiction which illustrate the musings of Marshall McLuhan's 1951 book, The Mechanical Bride. McLuhan wrote the book in a Cold War era, but warned of a more insidious danger lurking within both the democratic and the communist regions, technological man. He suggested that the mechanization of society cannot occur without the mechanization of its members, and he warned that in a new post-war social contract, we may lose our free will. The term cyborg did not exist when McLuhan wrote of Superman in 1951. First used in 1960 in Astronautics magazine, cyborg referred to a hypothetical human, mechanically augmented for life in space. This is precisely the sort of hybrid McLuhan suggested would develop from an interface between man and machine, an interdependent intermingling of the two. In Superman, McLuhan wondered if our answer to a machine world might be to become a machine. Conceived in 1935, a time of confrontation with different cultures, Superman became a figure of rescue for a plagued world, a character who fell from the skies, a benevolent alien protecting humans from each other. For the notion that humans could be programmed to respond as machines, take the Japanese kamikaze pilots or the Hitler Youth, was deeply disturbing. Likening Superman to the medieval angel for both exert energy of superhuman kind, McLuhan observed that humans have long fantasized about becoming similar to such beings. For instance, humans have historically imagined the synthesis of the natural with the unnatural. For example, in Egyptian synthetic figures, the more than human aspects of Egyptian gods were suggested by depicting them with the other than human attributes of animals. It is the putting together of two different entities, two different orders of being, that is shocking. The indwelling of an unnatural form in an interface of human and machine becomes the extension of McLuhan's commentary. We cope with the futility that humans feel in relation to great power by imagining Clark Kent, that which is not the fittest, coupled with great mechanical power. McLuhan suggested that we create these heroes to protect ourselves from what we fear. If we fear the other, then we take in the other, absorbing and assimilating it. In Superman, the character chooses to cross back and forth between his two forms, that of Clark Kent, the inept human, and Superman, the superhero. But in contemporaneous science fiction, the crossover becomes permanent and perhaps illustrates the more dire aspects of McLuhan's commentary on our increasing mechanization. Son of Superman. Often the metamorphosis is precipitated by some definitive event, permanently altering the biological body. This theme is illustrated in Keith Lamar's 1965 novel, A Plague of Demons. CBI agent John Brevias has undergone alterations to become a PAPA, a power-assisted personal armament, a coordinated development in bioprosthetics, neurosurgery, and myoelectronics to become a new weapon, the invulnerable man. Yet despite our efforts to make a Superman from the materials found on our Earth, that is, not to rely on that which might fall from the skies, we fail. Brevias is taken over by the aliens who defeat and decapitate him. He wakes to find his brain encapsulated within a 72-foot dreadnought, slave to an alien overmind. It is far cheaper and more efficient to use the well-designed human brain to power the war machine than building a mechanical brain. But a reoccurring stir of, quote, phantom memories, faint echoes of forgotten dreams of life, of flesh and blood, soft and complex, infinitely responsive, awakens the somnolent Brevias, freeing him from the overmind. Though his body has been disposed of, the human hero reasserts his humanity by stating, I am a man named Brevias. With the aliens waging war in hundreds of worlds, Brevias vows that he will fight for home wherever I find the enemy. The propaganda of the war machine found a receptive populace of post-war patriots. Uncle Sam needs you, and Brevias rallies to the cause. But it's almost as if he is the revenge for Superman. Where Superman is an alien protective of humans, Brevias is a human taken over by aliens who assails his fellow humankind. Brevias is a son of McLuhan's fantasy because he represents an extreme end product of societal mechanization. Daughter of Wonder Woman. McLuhan was not speculating within a cultural void. The hybrids he feared had already been envisioned by earlier writers. They described figures whose metamorphosis, once initiated, took on an uncontrolled and exponential growth. Once initiated, the human-machine synthesis quickly exceeds human control. In Love Goddess Assembly Line, McLuhan likens a dancing chorus line filled with bodies by Fisher, articulating smooth, clicking routines to the clockwork rigidity of a machine. Each member of this line becomes a replaceable part, max-factorized, streamlined, parts of a vast machine. This version of mechanical pleasure had been treated earlier in C.L. Moore's 1944 novella, No Woman Born, where Deidre,